like a mind shift for me. It was just like a, fuck you, I decide whether I let you invest.
I refuse to send anybody my deck. If you won't give me 15 minutes of your time, I'm not sending you my deck.
How many people did you speak to then?
72 funds over a 6-week period, 230 meetings.
There are definitely relationships we burnt along the way that we perhaps didn't need to.
There's 200 million active websites in the world that spend money on ads. 96 million of those spend $50,000 a month.
Look, you're all here because you've successfully started businesses and you've successfully raised money. And that's what I wanted to dig into today. What do you wish you'd known before you'd started? Guys, thank you very much for joining me. I am very excited to chat to you today about raising money in the UK. Joe, quick intro from you. Who are you? What do you do? Why are you here?
Yeah, I'm Joe. I run Spruce. In very simple terms, we make software for heat pump installers. So installing heat pumps is what has historically been incredibly painful for the people doing the work, which then creates an awful lot of grief for homeowners downstream of that. And we thought that was solvable, and we've gone and started trying to solve it.
Fab. We'll dig into more as we go. Paul?
Hey, Dom. My name is Paul Archer. I am the CEO and founder of a company called Duel. We're a brand advocacy platform. We work with the largest fashion, beauty, retail brands in the world to help them grow through the advocacy of their most passionate fans. So basically, we kind of see a world where companies should grow through word of mouth. We're a large enterprise solution working at the top end there, sort of as a strategic partner with the brands, and we make the platform that basically powers and scales all their advocacy operations.
Fab. And John?
So John Redman, founder and CEO of a business called AskBosco. We are an AI marketing and e-commerce analytics platform, and we help brands and agencies connect all their data into one place, create beautiful visualizations and let people talk to their data and get insights of exactly where they should spend their next pound, dollar or euro. And yes, yeah, so, and yeah, we're mainly focusing on the UK and the US and headquartered in the God's own country in Yorkshire.
Welcome, everybody. Look, you're all here because you've successfully started businesses, you're successfully scaling businesses, and you've successfully raised money. And that's what I wanted to dig into today, the raising money bit. How has it been? What's the market like? What did you find out? You know, what do you wish you'd known before you'd started even? So maybe Paul, you know, you've just raised a chunk of money. What are you going to do with it? And what do you know now you wish you'd known before?
What we could do with it? Yeah, like fast cars and all sorts. yeah, we spent a lot of money on engineers. That's the real sexy answer when you realise that you're spending and go to market investments. But it's kind of been an interesting journey. We've just done a Series A. We raised from European investors, even though we went out to market internationally, particularly focusing on the US. And the fundraising process was happening in October last year, which was a very, very different landscape to how it, well, I have no idea what it's like right now. I'm not fundraising, but like then it was like bleak. I don't think there had been a Series A out of the UK in almost a year that was of note. And it was really, really challenging to try and get that. We had great metrics. So we worked with some of the largest brands in the world, and we were sort of growing 100% year on year. And even then it was like pulling teeth. And it really kind of came down to finding a couple of investors who just locked in immediately. In the first meeting, it was like, yeah, we get this. We see the vision. We see where this is going. And you just kind of, I walked away from the first meetings just knowing that we were almost there. Those are the brands, those are the funds that ended up investing and leading our round.
How many people did you speak to then?
So I spoke to 72 funds over a 6-week period. I had 230 meetings and did ran quite a tight process. I mean I could bore you guys to death about how to run the process. And it was like we had a first round, then we had a second round, then we had like a first data room. First round, there was like a little bit of a sex, we called it the sexy data room, which is where they had a few of the sexy things and a high level deck and our high-level finance model, and then we had the deeper data room, and then we had the data room that happened on the third stage there. And you know, we only actually got to that final stage with the once we had a term sheet in place, but it was brutal to speak to all those funds, but continuously kind of running them through that piece, keeping them updated, keeping them hot. Oh yeah, we have just signed this new brand. We'd actually signed them a month previously, but we decided to keep that to ourselves just so we could make that, and got to the end there and finally managed to get a term sheet over the line. I told the team on Christmas Eve. So that was me sort of signing off broken after, you know, 3 months of like deal making. That we did it, and so it was, and we raised that Series A, and it was a great result from it, and I'm really excited about what we're building now on the other side of it. But God, it was brutal.
Was it serendipity that the first few people that you met were the people that you ended up taking all the way through, or do you prioritized it, or were they the people when you sent the information out they were the first to respond?
Well, interestingly, actually, one of the funds, Bright Pixel, who are the corporate venturing arm out of Sonai, which is a big Portuguese retailer, own quite a lot of brands, they had been hunting us down since before the round. And so as soon as I said, I'm going to market in September, let's talk about that, and they were like, okay, great, September, okay, it's gonna be October now, but you know, and bear with it. And so they were right away there and very keen from the get-go. But actually they took the longest to get to a run through their process, and then the other investor was Molten, who I think I spoke to them about midway through the pack of the first round of people and moved forward along with that process. And we probably had, I think, 20 funds went through to a deeper diligence stage. And actually, there were some people really excited about it, but a lot of the ones, the US funds, just we weren't fully in the US. About 80% of our revenue currently comes out of the US. Subsequently, we've now set up an office there. I'm moving out there. We have a full US entity. We are properly a US focused company now. But then it was kind of us promising that all of these things would happen. And a lot of the US funds got cold feet and they pulled out.
And if you'd, in the spirit of what do you know now, you'd know, if you'd already been out there, do you think you'd have got some of the US money over the line?
Yeah, I think so. I think it would have made things a lot easier for sure, knowing that. And interestingly, we actually have a much bigger AI play today than I was pitching back then. I was almost like I don't want to be yet another one of those people that changed their URL to have .ai at the end of it and then pitch the same business. I'm just quite obtuse about that. I just like wanted to run in the other direction. So I almost didn't lean in enough, even though a lot of these things were happening. Subsequently, what we're pitching now would have been far more of a sexier AI play. What we're doing now actually would have been a far more sexy AI pitch, interestingly. And that would have absolutely been the thing to be pitching to the US funds, because the way US funds and European funds is completely is completely different in the way that they operate, and depending on the tiers, like your top tier UK funds act more like a US fund for sure, but your tier twos, tier three sort of funds in the UK act very, very differently, and the way that you want to show up as a business is not right for that. And that's one of the things that I learned as well. I probably could have spoken to half as many people had I really gone into it and figured out what they actually invested in and the kind of growth trajectory that we were trying to pitch. It was pretty binary. You either, you're in it or you're not. And some people just don't like that.
Okay. Joe, what was your experience? Did you speak to that many people over that much, same type of time frame?
Not quite as extreme this time around, thankfully. But we probably spoke to about 50 funds, just maybe somewhere between 40 and 50 funds. The pre-seed, so which we did, a bit over a year previously, yeah, that was much more painful. That was well over 100 funds. A lot of frogs had to be kissed. Yeah, this time around, it was. I guess there were a couple of things that made it easier. Like, one was we had some real traction, and the traction was good, you know, kind of, so we had some sort of real numbers to point people at. And then we also benefited from one fund basically preempted the round, and so kind of came in early, said we'll do it, or we'll do some of it. And then obviously that's often the painful thing, is trying to get someone to, you know, say they'll do it to begin with, and you can create some urgency. But we were able, you know, as a result of that, to have urgency from the get-go, and obviously that forces some people into quicker no's, but it also means that you do create a bit more of a buzz around it, which made the process, yeah, less painful and less strung out than the previous one, although not, still not joyous overall. Yeah,
the raise you did how long does that give you? When do you think you have to go do it again?
I always find it like a weirdly difficult question to answer, because it very much depends on what happens to our revenue. And if, you know, there's in that same period, it's the kind of, so it's always fun. So we're planning around it being like sort of 2 to 3 years. So kind of at the moment, kind of, you know, it's comfortably more than 3 years, but we're kind of trying to increase spend by trying to find some good hires. So we're trying to kind of shorten the runway. In terms of timing of the next one, I mean, we kind of, our default assumption is that we'll go out probably beginning of 2027. So kind of, which is effectively 18 months on, or maybe just over 18 months on from when we did the seed. As a sort of separate point, the way Steph, my co-founder, and I sort of think about it is we'd like to try and do that from a position of strength. So I kind of raise that next round, not because we absolutely have to in that moment, because we're about to run out of money, but because it's like, that's the right strategic moment to go and significantly increase capital expenditure. But I mean, that's the dream anyway. And that's what we're planning towards. We'll see what actually happens.
And what do you know now that you wish you'd known earlier?
If I could do it again, you know, it's difficult to say how much faster it would have gone, but we could have made, you know, there are definitely relationships we burnt along the way that we perhaps didn't need to. I probably should have learned this lesson from raising the pre-seed, but maybe slightly forgot it or willfully forgot it, which is that you often have one chance. And if, you know, a fund might tell you, oh, we'll keep in touch or get back to us in a couple of months or whatever it is, it just never really happens. Like, once you've had that conversation, and if you haven't, you know, based on some of the earlier conversations, we haven't really got ducks in a row. We hadn't kind of, you know, the pitch deck was fine, but ended up needing to get an awful lot better. We hadn't prepared, you know, like good enough questions, basically, to all the common questions that we sort of started getting. And so I think the thing that got a lot better as the round went on was that we had a much more refined pitch that was much more compelling, where you saw people light up much more quickly in the course of those conversations, as opposed to kind of, you know, you can, you know, earlier on you start to see people get bored or shut down. And we had just much tighter answers to the kind of, whatever it is, 30, 40 common questions that people were coming up with. And so you just come across a lot better as a result of that. I think, if, you know, with hindsight, if we'd spent more time planning and preparing it, those weren't really unforeseen. You know, we could have planned those ahead a little bit more, spent more time with our existing investors, that I think definitely would have made it less painful.
Did you strategically pick people you didn't think would invest to talk to beginning, or did you try and prioritize them and go with the best people first, even though the deck got better later? What?
So having some strategy around the timing of who I'm talking to, which, yeah, the timing would have been a good thing, I think. So we didn't do that. I think what I ended up doing was speaking to people where there was some kind of ongoing conversation, or where I'd like met people in an event or whatever it was. So I wasn't sort of tactically going, you know, great, you know, like let's go and burn a few people, I'll learn some lessons and then we'll do it. I think in hindsight I should have done that, and that would have been better, but yeah, you know, it's another lesson to chalk up.
Fab. John.
So, you know, I don't think I spoke to enough people based on you guys now. I just went very efficient. The first thing I did is I went, I've been through processes before, so I went back to people who give me term sheets before and said, right, I'm thinking of raising some money, would you back me again, sort of thing. And they were like, oh yeah, we only write checks for £25 million now, John. And but we've sold our small VC business to these guys. So what was interesting in that scenario, though, both of those businesses had sold. So one was Mobius and one was Living Bridge. They had a branding issue. They used to be called ISIS. So they needed a rebrand. So anyway, they both told me to go speak to Gresham House Ventures and this guy who I sort of knew called Trevor, who actually ended up doing the round. Right, so that could have been a much quicker, easier thing. Let's just go, Trevor, let's do the deal. However, we did run a proper process. And then there's two things I think I did differently, which goes against all the stuff you read on LinkedIn or what everybody tells you to do. I did do what Paul did, though. We had like the sexy paid for fancy full on SaaS data room that you pay for initially as like the teaser. And then we switched that off and turned it into a more traditional data room later down the line once we got into some serious conversations. And I do think that works, makes you more professional, puts in your case studies. And then what was sort of interesting is I refused to send anybody my deck if they wouldn't have a meeting with me, right? And I don't know if that's a thing or not, but I've been reading about, like, well, how many decks do you get that you just delete, right? You don't want my deck. If you won't give me 15 minutes of your time, I'm not sending you my deck. So that maybe that's why I had a lot less meetings, because people were just thinking, well, who's that bullshit Yorkshire bloke who won't send me his deck? And I'm like, well, look, give me 15 minutes and I can articulate it and we can talk about it. And then I can decide if I actually even want to send it to you. So I sort of switched it around a little bit. That put a lot of people off, I think. But it also intrigued a few people. We ended up with 3 term sheets, all competitive, and ended up raising sort of more than we'd wanted, a good valuation. In terms of what would I do differently, I'd have probably explored family offices earlier, because I think there's an interesting market in family offices, and I only found out about it a couple of weeks before we closed, and I thought, well, how did I not know about this world? And I think it's a world that people don't think they can access, but there are, if you know the right ways to do it, which I now do, there is some interesting money and funds and opportunity in there that come with the less strings attached than to VC money. And I think it was something we were talking about in the sort of thing, is like understanding why you need to raise. We raised for strategic reasons, that now puts us on a path to exit and puts us on a sort of a vision. We could have raised, so we wanted institutional money as opposed to going to our angels. So this was a strategic decision. We could have raised a similar amount of money from our existing angels who had the firepower to do it and had the appetite to do it. But actually, I think by taking on institutional money, this sets us on a course for a strategic exit in a particular time, or a further bigger raise to then with some secondaries and this and that. And I think tactically for us, we all decided, and many of my angels sat on the board at the time. And then I suppose the other thing we did, we got a bit of advice. I think you might have been involved in a bit of this advice, Tom, was we reorganised our board with a competitive external process before we took the money, so that we didn't have, including our chairman, non-execs, this, that and the other, so that when we took the money on, they couldn't impose their people into the board, which caused a lot of frustration on everybody's sides and a lot of negotiation. But by the end of it, they were very keen for me to incentivise our board to stay, because they realised actually we had an amazing board and they were really good. But we started off with those, well, you've got to take our chair, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. But yeah, it was an interesting process. It took me ages compared to Paul, it sounds like. It took me absolutely ages. We started the process last October and I got the money in June. All right, so that took ages.
Oh, that took ages, because I was just getting to term sheet. That was then we had to go into due diligence.
We can talk about due diligence later. That was painful.
A moment ago, you talked about not sending people your pitch deck. I was talking to someone last week, and they were saying they're the single best book they've ever read to help them fundraise, and they've fundraised a lot, is The Game by Neil Strauss. And basically treating the whole, if you basically take that but apply it to fundraising or apply it to building relationships with investors, they said that's just essentially what they do. So I wonder whether actually what you're doing there is kind of fits into that kind of model of it, of just like, you know, treating mean, keeping keen, you know, not being in any way kind of forthright, helpful, kind of like looking in any way keen for building a relationship with them, and therefore as a result of that, luring them in.
And the first thing you do is just neg them, isn't it? Is that you
exactly? Take this
It's literally a plot in Silicon Valley, is that he goes down the Sand Hill Road and he negs them, and he keeps getting bigger and bigger offers after he does this. It's brilliant. But it's also true, right? So I think that kind of one of the things that's like I always found really helpful, because like there's a lot of arrogance in VC, right? That most of that, you've got VCs that come from a strong background, that have worked, and they, you know, they're exited entrepreneurs, and we're fortunate to be working with those guys. There's also a lot of kids that went to a good school that are the associates that you talk to. And the first people, off first tier, you speak to the associates. The partners have often built businesses and things like that, the associates. They have the arrogance and the swagger, but they've never actually had a real job. Sometimes they've worked for McKinsey, which I'm not sure if that counts. But like they've kind of got that kind of pedigree, and they all went to the schools, and they all have that same, like at the same time, you lock on to the same new associate that comes on. And they act with a sort of a nonchalance of like, yes, well, we might give you our money. And actually the most fundamental sort of thing, like a mind shift for me, was just like a fuck you, I decide whether I let you invest, because my company is going places and we're going to return your fund, or we're going to return someone else's funds. So don't talk to me like that. And actually, if you have that mentality when you go in, you do have a certain swagger, which is needed, because that's part of the game as well, in the same way. And I think that, like, you just at the end of the day, you just need to remember they're just bankers and gilets. There's not that much difference to them, right? Like, they just pretend they're cool, occasionally wear hoodies, go down to Shoreditch, talk the talk, go to these sort of startup meetings, like, glad had anyone's like feeling like a superstar at the Web Summit. But they're just bankers. They're just gonna, they do all the grunt work, they run through the spreadsheets just like everyone else. And it's the partners that have all the yachts and everything like that and really make the decisions for it. And so how do you get into those guys is the crucial piece. And if you can't get a meeting with the partner within the very first sort of stages, the deal's probably going to go nowhere and you should walk away.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Paul. Where the ones where we got real traction, we'd already had intros into the partner and then they referred down. The other thing we did, and this was tactical, off some advice, a friend of mine, was we went to SaaS Stock, knowing that a lot of the people we'd already started having conversations with were at SaaS Stock. And then I went in my bright yellow t-shirt and made sure that the ones who I know, thought knew were already interested in us saw me meeting, having speed dates with loads of other VCs and other people as well. So talk about that sort of trying to create a competitive environment. And then I'm sort of, oh, sorry, I haven't got time to, I'm just going to talk to these guys. And it wasn't until afterwards, and I sat around and thought about that, that was actually, it worked quite well because they could see that lots of other people were interested in your business. And I think also it's a, going to something like that is a good validation quite quickly, A, of your story, and B, are you genuinely investable? Because they haven't got time to waste either. And if you don't get the follow-up, then you know you're not. So yeah, those sorts of events are often a bit daunting, but I'd recommend those sorts of, and SaaS, actually in Dublin, great, loads of Guinness, it's quite good fun as well.
Yeah, I did on Paul's point about the associates. It's definitely funny though, because it's like, I mean, obviously there are some brilliant associates out there who are really nice, really interested, really want to understand your business. Sometimes even, ask you questions. You're like, oh, I really should know the answer to that. I'm gonna have to go and think about that. Whatever. But it's very bizarre with the ones that don't realize that they're actually having to sell themselves, or when it gets towards the end of a process, and then suddenly they switch into, oh no, please, can now we give you some money? And you've gone, well, hang on, you've spent the first few calls where, with me looking, looking like I'm wasting your time, and then there's this sort of last minute switch. It feels like it's like a strange that it's so common, because you feel like the sort of system which should almost filter it out, because I can't believe there are many founders who get to the end of a process and go, oh, brilliant, I really want to have that, whatever it is, that kind of ex-McKinsey consultant who was looking down their nose at me because I'm just another founder looking for money. I can't quite piece that together, because I think the really good ones are, they'll just be quick and direct, and they might say no, they might not believe in it, but they're very, nice and polite, because if it is right, you'll want to come back to them later on.
The money's important, but if you've got a good business, like Paul said, you're going to find somebody who wants to invest the money. But also, you're going to spend time with these people, and you want to get on with them. And it's almost as important, if not more important, than hiring someone on your senior team. And I think sometimes people don't look at it like that because they just get so obsessed. Is actually at this point we're going to run out of cash, so we need to raise the money in order so that doesn't happen. And I do agree with Joe mentioned about when he's going to raise his next round and this, that, and the other. And yeah, you need to make sure that you're not desperate, and you need to make sure, because if you get close to the wire, then they know that and they'll see that in the due diligence and they'll work it out, and then the I suppose the power shift changes.
And I was just going to say, I've sat in some other side of the table with the guys with the money, with the VCs. And having only ever seen that sort of arrogant swagger, it was actually quite funny to sit the other side of the table. And they're like teenagers. Do you think you let us? Do you think you let us invest? Like, the arrogance completely disappears, and they've got more money they can spend. They've got more money than they've got good companies to invest in, and they realize it's competitive, and they might not get to deploy the capital that they need to deploy this year, and that absolutely, they're terrified. And so, in the room with nobody looking, it is like watching the girls chat at a school disco. Do you think he likes me? Do you think he does? Like, can we talk to one of his mates and find out what he really thinks? Just really, really funny.
I would never want to be a VC. It seems the most stressful job in the world, because actually there's like time horizons of deploying money and getting them out the door, which is one thing. And then when they do find an investment, they make the investment, and then they can't really see any upside for, you know, 5+ years, other than going into a board meeting where you hear bad things, because yeah, that's what board meetings are, right? You kind of, yeah, there's some good things, but there's also the bad things. And then you can't actually drive any change within the investment. You just have to sit there on your hands for 5 years before you see an outcome. And just the anxiety that must drive, plus the constant anxiety that you might not sign the Beatles and miss Stripe coming across your desk. Like, it's just constant anxiety. You've got to have more and more meetings. I do really, really feel for it. And I think that's kind of one of the things that, like, I've learned through going through. This is like our fifth round or something. I've gone through various different rounds of seed and pre-seed and so on, and seed plus and all sorts of different monikers that we could put on it. But like the thing that I didn't understand was that the type of funds and the type of investment and actually the maths of what an exit needs to be for certain funds. And so I sat down with my seed fund. We did that with Superseed, who are incredible SaaS specific funds, and they just do SaaS. They do vertical boring SaaS. So we are on the like right on the side of what they would do, and they just really sort of help it go forward. And the thing that I realized through this conversation is like different funds have different sizes and therefore have different return profiles that they'd expect for it. So if a fund is a 20 million pound fund, then they're kind of looking for 20 million pounds back. They can make smaller investments, they can make more incremental ones, but if it's 50 or if it's 500, then actually they often need to make bigger and bigger bets that have bigger and bigger outcomes. And so therefore they typically have to invest bigger and bigger checks with bigger and bigger outcomes off the other side of that as they try and do it. And then depending on the risk profile that you've got. So if you're looking for a classic VC 10x return, then every single investment, if you're a $50, $100 million investment, has to be likely to return the fund. So if they're buying, you know, shares in your company, which give or take 15, 20%, it's kind of what it like, max that will end up being, they then, for them to get a $100 million return, then actually they need to know that your business has to drive $400, $500, $600, $700 million at an exit. And then you then do the total addressable market calculations of actually, well, how big is this market? And if we were to have, you know, 5% of this market share, what could we sell for, or 10% or whatever it is. And so there's a lot of funds that literally just won't, like for incredible businesses. And I think it's one of the things that founders, I never knew, and I got offended when they turned around. I was like, what's wrong with my business? What's wrong with me? You're basically telling me my baby's ugly. But actually, just if the TAM isn't right, and if they don't see the ability for you to actually grow and give that sort of level of a return, it's just not right for them. And that's going to be the case for the vast majority of businesses they look at. It doesn't even matter how good the business is, the founder or anything. It's literally just the return profile of it.
I remember when I was, you know, I'm probably still quite naive to the whole process, but particularly naive when raising the pre-seed. And I remember what felt like very baffling feedback at the time from someone where we had very positive conversations. They'd asked really good questions. It all seemed to be quite good. And then their feedback was, you know, pretty direct, was, look, we really like it, really like you. Can see a clear path to 10, 20 million a year revenue, but just not sure you'll get to 300 or 400 million a year revenue. And I was obviously there with a kind of business that barely existed, going, well, bloody hell, you think we can get to 20 million a year revenue? That's amazing. That's awesome. But it's a no, though, is it? You know, but for that exact reason, just because it just then, you know, in terms of their fund economics, it just doesn't work. Realizing you're playing this game and understanding, you know, as Paul, as you're saying, like, actually who it is, not all VCs or not all funds are the same, and therefore they're kind of, you know, and I think that probably changes again, or is more likely to change again when you go to the US, where like again you've got like even bigger funds with even bigger outcomes, you know, which kind of again make what might look good to a European investor suddenly seem less appealing to that US counterpart.
Yeah, I'd echo all of that. Is the US, the big guys, they do want you to return the whole fund, and that's and the pressure. But there are certain UK funds who are looking at the world in a different way. That comes with different things. They're maybe not run by entrepreneurs. They might be run more by accountants. But it depends on what you need the money for, what your timescales are, and what. And the other bit, which I got given some bad advice, that some people said, oh, don't go into the conversation knowing your end exit. you, because it's for them to help you form that and go on that journey together. Whereas actually, by the time we got to term sheets, what excited them is the fact that I'd actually thought about what the end exit was, and I had multiple options, and we had a number, and we had a plan, and we knew exactly how we were going to get there. Whereas some people thought, no, that's the VC's job to help you do that, and this, that, and the other. So that gave them, I think, some confidence in the fact that I'd not only worked out the TAM and all of that, and the SAM and the SOM and everything, we got it all nailed down into all of, like, we can go and get exactly these people that are worth this much money. And then, because we've got all these people, somebody like this might want to buy us. I'd had some advice that, no, you're overthinking it. They won't be able to demonstrate that they can add the value. But actually, I think they liked it because they thought, well, these people have thought about this and I get it. But the other interesting thing that I think helped us a lot, though, was initially our TAM was so big that it was almost unbelievable. Right, so you do need to have some sanity and vanity check on then, well, splitting it down. Because my first conversation was, well, then these are the sort of numbers. The only reason I know this is we've just onboarded our, talking about what you spend the money on, we've just onboarded our VP of sales. Aaron started today, Dom, and I was running him through the investment deck. And I said, well, there's 200 million active websites in the world that spend money on ads. 96 million of those spend over $50,000 a month. So we've got 96 million people we can go sell our software to. And that's just a little bit unbelievable. So then we sort of talked about how can we focus down and get down and into the niche of it. But I do think, to echo everything you've said, is understanding where to go fishing and what do you want out of it. Because if you are going to get to that 700 million, yeah, there's, you need to have the story to back that up. But also, what level of pressure do you want? And if you haven't done it before, go talk to people who have done it before. Because the minute you get institutional money on board, the game will change, right? When you've got angels on board, especially if the angels are sort of known to you and this and the other, you're still reasonably in control and there's nobody checking your numbers on top of you all the time. The minute you get institutional money on board, like I had to ask permission the other day to give someone a pay rise. Right. And I was like, it was quite a big pay rise. And it was in the terms of what we've done. It had to go to the remuneration committee. And what I realized is we haven't formed the remuneration committee yet. So I have to have a board meeting to form the remuneration committee in order to remunerate the person. So I was just like, this is like, I'm just, what happens if I don't do that? Well, that's not a good start, is it, John?
Paul, did you have to take investor representation on your board?
Yeah, I mean, we'd raised quite a lot. We raised $16 million, and so it kind of is a different stage. But even when we did our seed, we took and willingly took on Superseed onto our board because they were massive collaborators in the business, and I think that they are quite unusual for kind of a UK fund who, I think most of them have that sort of element that John was talking about, like acting more like private equity, who kind of act like they know how to run a business rather than their job, which is to find someone who's got a business and knows how to run a business and get the hell out of their way, which really is what I think the better investors know how to do very well, and then to facilitate those. We've gone through that process. Yeah, we did a co-lead situation, which I've a lot of love for the investors that came in, and I think there's nothing wrong with what they've done personally, but actually a co-lead situation is not ideal. Had I known this, I probably would have structured it differently at the time, because the problem with co-lead is, like, you have two equal investors coming in, you then have to get the terms agreed with both of them, they all have to be on the page for it, and actually everyone was very reasonable in the due diligence process. But if you've got to go through twice as many people for every single topic, then it has an exponential effect on how long it takes you to get anything done. And so therefore, I mean, our legals took longer and more expensive and all those things for no one's fault, but purely because of the structure of the deal, and so therefore we had two people sitting on our board. But mirrored within the organization as well from the company side to kind of represent that, so you don't just have investor directors having the control there. And I think that negotiating those elements of what needs to be approved is something which is important, because you don't really think about it when you're in the depths of due diligence that actually, if I need to ask someone for a pay rise, it's going to slow me down. And I think the key thing about raising capital is, again, as another mindset shift, which I've sort of learned through this, is you raise capital to move faster. Like, capital is time, and speed is absolutely of the essence. So if you're getting someone who's going to give you money, yet also drag the brakes in the business, and that's going to be bad for you because you're going to have the expectations to grow, but they're going to be the ones getting in the way of it. And actually, one of the advice that we've had coming aboard with the new investors, they're like, most founders are not comfortable with spending that much money that fast. They don't do it fast enough. We still worry about the various different things. I mean, we just opened up our New York office and we kitted it out on like an absolute shoestring. but we did it like all the way that we would have done, like loads of time and effort to try and do it. And they're like, yeah, you could have just got someone else to do that. And it's like, oh yeah, good point. There's that times a load of times, like, should you use recruiters? Don't use recruiters. There's no point in using recruiters. What do they bring to the party? I can do this perfectly well. And it's just like, yeah, they're going to do it like three times faster. And at the end of the day, three times faster is, actually, you're getting, let's say, a head of sales, just like you said. If you can get a head of sales in who's great, like John's done, or we're in the process of hiring for a CTO, it's like a CFO, like the faster they can join, the faster they can drive impact. So actually, if you're going to spend tens of thousands on a recruiter, it actually makes sense, because in the long term scheme of things, that's nothing compared to the impact they can have. And if they can join 3 months earlier, that impact is exponential by the time you start running down on your runway and 18, 24 months after that. And so, like, it's a different mindset. And I think the thing is, it's not right for most businesses. Like, the vast majority of businesses that go out to try and raise capital, people who are running those, it's not right. VC is a very niche asset class that is only right for a very, very, very small number of businesses that are growing very, want to grow very quickly and have a very big outcome potential, and are willing to bet the farm on doing that. Most of them, there's great ways of raising capital, but it's not VC. There's like EIS funds, there's some things called growth equity. Never heard of growth equity when I was doing seed, until realized it. But once you're over $5, $10 million, then actually there's this new asset class, which is kind of like private equity, but it's not. It's kind of like VC, but it's not, somewhere in between. Didn't know that even existed. But like, it is like VC itself is a tiny, tiny niche in the fundraising world. And I had no awareness of this when I started the business.
Well, and as John was saying earlier, now he knows that family offices are a thing as well. And so there's all these extra places you can raise money.
I was just going to say, in the family office thing, it's not, they've got big checkbooks. And they can make really quick decisions, and they've already got an investment thesis. It was just trying to, and I didn't even, I knew it was a thing, but I just didn't know how to get access to it. And then if you try and work it out, they don't have very good websites. They're not advertising the fact they're giving away loads of money. You've got to know Charles Ponsonby, what's it, who knows somebody who knows somebody. And I just thought, that's not for me, right? That's just not for me. Anyway, if anybody does want to get into family offices now, I know there's a way in and there's a thing, but it would have been a bit like taking money from more of our angels. And I don't know if it would have set us on this course that obviously Paul's already on now with his Series A and et cetera, is if you are going to go really big, having institutional money on, they sort of know the game and they know what's involved and they can make sure you're structured and you've got the right team and everything else. I think our guys have been surprised how good we are at spending money quite quickly. We got given a 100-day plan of what we had to recruit and what we had to do, and yeah, that's I'm quite comfortable in deploying the capital, as they would put it.
What did you think of the due diligence process, John? What value did that add?
Yeah, you know, some of the, I think,
or maybe the question, so that you don't have to throw anyone under a bus, is what is it you would have done differently if you were doing it again now, knowing what you know now?
Well, I think the due diligence is obviously important. And I think the financial due diligence, the guy doing that was really thorough, very good, understood our business. I think the sales and marketing and go-to-market stuff. My frustration is that as the person, and maybe this is just me, I done like a kip, I don't know, but I paid for all the due diligence for them to invest their money, right? So maybe... that's like, well, hang on, but that just seems to be how the deal is. And they were saying, oh, it's this much for this, it's this much for that. And I'm like, well, hang on, that's a lot of money. And it's, a lot of it's on time and materials. And one of these people wasn't even using any form of AI to take notes or record meetings, and then was handwriting it all up. And I'm like an AI business, and I'm like, this is ridiculous. Right? I could cut my bill in half if you just use this thing that takes some notes. Anyway, what was interesting, though, the technical due diligence, to be fair, it was really helpful in terms of it just reassured me as a non-technical founder that a lot of the things that I needed to scratch were right, but we had built an amazing product. We had identified a market. We'd already got traction, but we needed some more serious, sensible, serious technical people. So, yeah, due diligence, it just felt like someone rummaging around in your drawers a lot. And I thought we were super organised and everything was in the right compartment and we'd spent loads of time and effort being... But they always ask a different question in a different way, and you've got to redo the spreadsheet. And it, when you want the money and you want to get the deal going, you're sat there at 11 o'clock at night redoing a pivot table a different way or reformatting a thing, and it's just hard. And if I hadn't had a COO who knew it inside out, it would have killed me because it is hard. And I can't imagine what Paul did with two co-investors, because that'd have been, they'd have had the, you'd have had four questions in four different ways for four different spreadsheets. And you want to say to them, Dom, right, you're good at Excel, do it yourself. Right, but you can't, right? Because you can't, because you're sort of in this thing, aren't you? They're like, oh, can we see the numbers this way? Or can we see that? And you feel like saying, well, you could do that, and you're probably better at Excel than me.
Well, I think you can, though, John. I think that's one of the things that...
Well, that's, I clearly missed the trick there, Paul, because I...
Yeah, because there's due diligence, and there's also the pre-term sheet due diligence as well, which is on the lighter of things, and they're asking for more and more questions. I think one of the things that we learned, given the sheer scale of the number of people we were talking to, was to say, these are the numbers. And it's like, oh, we want it this way. It's like, no, you just take it.
This was post-term sheet sort of stuff, getting into it, or when we were like closing it off. But the pre-term sheet, that was it. What's in that room's in the room. Make your decision.
Yeah, agree.
And I suppose the other bit which was interesting is we cut a lot of people out. We also demanded to see everybody face to face, which again, I don't think many people do.
Did you make them come to Yorkshire?
Yeah. I made them get on the train and come to, and if they didn't want to come to Yorkshire, I didn't want to take their money.
They'll have had to check the vaccine status and if their passport was up to date. Yeah, yeah. I wonder they didn't travel.
Half of them have decided to move here now, I think. no, but I was just like, I want to meet these people. It's really important. It's really important. And again, I think we've all got used to doing this, which is important. But
did you get any pushback on the fact you only work a four-day week?
So for Paul and Joe's benefit, we work 4-day week, we pay full-time salary, above average benefits, one of the best technology businesses to work for in the UK. We are the best outside London. And yeah, yes, no, because they daren't say it, because all the data backs it up, right? But I know you've got a view of, well, surely you'd be 20% more efficient, you'd be 20% more output if you just weren't so lazy. the data backs it up. We have, I think we had something like 8 sick days in the whole year across 40 people last year. Nobody phones in sick. People want to come to work, and we measure them on output. So I've got the data. They like that.
Dom actually was singing your praises when we were having a coffee a couple of weeks ago. So he probably puts up a good face. He was actually telling me about how much it was working for you. So sorry, throwing you under the bus there. Your hard nosed facade has been cracked. But the way that he positioned it to me that I thought was super interesting, because we've got like a hyper high trust freedom sort of approach that you choose whenever you want to work, but it's not like dictated whenever. It's like you just kind of work around your life and things like that. He was saying that with you, and tell me if this is true, is like there's a 4-day work week, but like the high performers work a 5-day work week, but they pick and choose when they work, and they kind of have that freedom, and that's that. And if the fact is you're able to attract them because of it, but they end up working more than that, and that's not a problem.
It's about managing that, though, because you don't want people then to be seen, everybody is, oh, in order to get on I have to do 5 days. It's about managing that. Some of them do, but also they don't have to. So then if they don't want to, there's no pressure to take meetings or do stuff. A lot of people are doing additional research or reading, thinking, going to events, this, that and the other. Or the other flip side of that is if somebody isn't performing and they're under, say, performance management, we haven't had many, we reserve the right to take it away. right? So it's like, if you're not getting your work done, and we measure on outputs, OKRs, and we have the scorecard, and we have it all sort of, if you're not doing what you're meant to be doing, then you need to come to work more. And if we then don't get it sorted, you won't be coming to work. But, you know, we didn't, to answer your question, we didn't get any pushback.
Joe, what do you, how do you attract the best talent to your business? You know, you're not doing a four-day week. You have to actually turn up. How have you been able to attract talent?
Yeah, I'm quite excited to start doing a five-day week. That's currently what I'm trying to get myself down to. But not what we expect of employees. I don't think we do as much as we could. Like, we haven't been super proactive to date on, in terms of, like, proactively building an employer brand and sort of like working on the kind of, you know, the top of funnel recruitment marketing stuff. I mean, I think we're helped by the fact that it's a pretty company friendly market at the moment. We've seen something like 3,500 applications in the last couple of months across a number of roles. Obviously, a lot of them are, you know, don't get past, you know, application stage. Yeah, we're definitely seeing very high volumes. I mean, I guess it's, we do something good, you know, it kind of like sort of the sort of we're aligned with that mission purpose, trying to, you know, we're trying to push, help the country push towards net zero and getting there faster, like decarbonizing heating and buildings. I think that works for a lot of particularly younger people, but people of all ages really, who kind of want to feel like they're doing something good, but it's something that's also interesting, fun, you know, and where they're going to be challenged and where they're going to learn well. The other thing we have is we're half in London, half in Bristol, and we actually have slightly more people in Bristol than London, which nearly every role we look in both places, and I sort of would have assumed that at this stage we would have ended up with more people in London just because of there being more people. But I think actually being in Bristol helps because there's increasing number of people, you know, not living in London, living in regional cities, who want to be able to work in person and work for something that's fun, sexy, interesting, kind of fast growing. So I think actually we've sort of inadvertently realised that we stand out better in a smaller city, and so therefore you kind of, you're better able to kind of attract the, you know, attract the kind of the very best people there, where it's obviously tougher to attract the very best in London. But yeah, there's a lot more we'd love to do.
Paul, opening an office in New York, how did you find attracting the opening talent for you?
Eye-wateringly expensive. Like, unfathomably expensive. It blows my mind still. How much people get paid, but also how much people need to get paid. Just to kind of put this into perspective, like a two-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn, not in Manhattan, in Brooklyn, is going to set you back between $7,500 and $9,500 a month. Like, it's, and that's an okay one. Has a balcony, right? You know, and a doorman. But, like, it's just astronomical how expensive it is out there. So, therefore, you kind of figure out, well, how much does that cost if you need to have, you know, you got two kids and a dog and everything like that. So like, people just get paid a lot more. But there is a kind of a capital city. Well, it's not technically capital, but you know what I mean. Sort of mindset that we've seen, because actually, Joe, we were the same. We started in Bristol, and all our engineering is still kind of hovering around Bristol, though they're largely remote in the surrounding areas. But we actually found that for marketing and sales talent, we struggle to find the people who've seen that movie once or a couple of times before that are the really ones who can add, like, who can really add value. You know, I mean, you're growing very quickly. If you sort of double headcount year on year, we've done that pretty consistently for the past 5 years or so. Like, you can't train people up. You actually often have to buy people who've done the thing before, because you don't have enough time, because by the time that person is sort of trained up in what you're doing, actually the company has already doubled and it's changed and morphed massively. So you have to sometimes just go to the market, and that I would wish that we'd be able to really bring up like an amazing grad scheme, and we'll get there, but we just haven't been there at this sort of stage. And we've found that we had to find that talent in London. And then the same thing is true in New York and in the States, is like, we've scattered around trying to find people where they, you know, it's considerably cheaper. Yeah, I mean, San Francisco is still the most expensive, but New York is, yeah, a solid 50% on top of London in terms of the price point.
Are you sending anybody from the UK over, or did you say you were going over as well, or...?
Yeah, so we're bringing a couple of folks. I'm heading over there as well with my family at some point, as soon as my visa gets approved. With the talent, it is still worth investing in that as a city for us, because our customers are fashion and beauty brands, and New York is the center of the universe for that. So, and like, we did the math on it, or math, as I would say there, where like, of the 2,500 brands in our ideal customer profile that we'd target, I think it was just under 40% of them had an office in New York. The next highest was 9% in LA. Next highest was Columbus, Ohio, actually, which interesting, like from a retail perspective, which is like sub 1%. So there's, from a go-to-market perspective, New York is everything. We can go there and we can build a brand. You can make it there, you can make it anywhere, as they say. But like we can actually have a kind of quite a deep penetration in quite a narrow geographical area. So therefore, all our go-to-market activities is our focus there, right? So we're investing in events and dinners. Like we've just opened up our office as a clubhouse. So it's like it's a half office, half event space that our brands can use for their various different events that they want to use, podcast studio. So it's like a sort of pseudo membership model. And that's a brand building investment for us to like just have this impact that we need to make. Because once you've got that as a beachhead, well, this is our theory anyway, which, by the way, was largely disagreed with by almost all the VCs we met, is that this is our beachhead for getting into the US. And then once we've got that bit, the word of mouth effect will drive. And we literally do word of mouth for a living, which is kind of what I had to sort of tell quite a lot of the go-to-market experts that told us that we were wrong. It's like, no, this is how you create a brand. This is how you create reputation. But the downside of that is the salaries. All the benchmarking data that comes from the platforms is wrong. It's much higher. Like we found actually asking ChatGPT to be the most reliable one of actually how people get paid. And yeah, it blows your mind. So we've had to be very mindful about the type of roles that we put in New York. They're all going to be customer facing. We have the reason to be there. Everything else we offshore to the UK if we can do it, and have a few people working later hour models and things like that. So it's like, it's quite a tricky puzzle trying to figure this out. And I suspect it's not fully sustainable going forward. We need people in the US time zone from the support and from technical services. And, you know, we've explored Toronto as a strong option because that's, you know, great talent, capital city, but, you know, less than half the price of what New York would be. And so, yeah, it's an interesting one, but we're all in New York for at least the next year. All our headcount is all in New York. It's 3 days in the office. We're building it out because the culture doesn't exist, and so we've got to build that from scratch, and that's like a whole nother problem.
Fab. John, I'm conscious that we're getting towards the end, and I haven't had people hear from you your negotiation top tip. Let's get into that.
Yeah, no, so interesting. Paul said it before, is like the VCs will actually quietly like founders with a bit of confidence, and they want to actually, because they ultimately, that's how you're going to negotiate their exit at the end, right? Because you're going to be in the box seat to do that, and they want to back someone who's got something. So anyway, I was I'm part of an entrepreneurs networking group called ICE. They organize. Are you an ICER?
John, I went on holiday with you earlier this year. I don't know if you noticed.
I was like, at the same time. You were on my ski trip.
Yeah, I'm so glad that I made such an impact.
I've been sat here going, I know this guy, but I didn't want to be the guy go, have we met? So I was, anyway, yeah.
To be fair, you were running it. You were up there.
I was organizing
the ski trip in front of everyone. I was sitting in the back drunk and going snowboarding. So, apologies. We never actually spoke, but it was a great trip. Well done.
Yeah, thanks. You're a snowboarder, though. That was the problem.
Yeah. There you go.
No, so anyway, I was organizing the lunches and making sure everybody was getting fed. Anyway, I'm also trying to negotiate a term sheet with the VC at the same time as being on the trip. So that restaurant on the first day, I'm trying to make sure the food, and it was like half inside, outside, it was about to start snowing. I was like, well, have we got any options here? And I'm trying to negotiate this term sheet. And I'm like, no, we're not doing that. We're not doing this. This isn't good enough. And they're like listening. And someone on the trip had advised me, send them over in advance what your position is. So I'd emailed them my position so they could have a thing. And then we were running through my email. And anyway, and then I just said, and I think this one's a deal breaker. And then the phone cut out. And they thought that I'd put the phone down on them. Then everybody from the ICE trip starts turning up for lunch. And I've got to organise the lunch. And I'm like, I'll just deal with that later. And I couldn't get back through to them. And I'd lost my signal completely. And anyway, by the time we got to the end of the lunch, I just had this email go, yeah, we'll agree to everything you want. I think there was one thing that was a bit like, but they genuinely thought I'd just like hung up on them. I'm not suggesting that. I don't know if I've got the confidence to do that, but I maybe should have done.
Okay, as we wrap up, just so that people have got, put this in context, what's your ARR? How much did you raise? Just so that people can take the conversation and they've got some context as they're thinking about the things that we've been talking about. John?
So we're on track for 3 million and we raised 4.1 from a small VCT fund.
Okay. Joe?
So we raised a bit over 3 million. At the time, we're a couple of hundred K ARR, which is in, we're now a little bit closer, so should hit 1 million by Christmas, basically. So we're kind of, it's grown quite a lot in the few months since.
Fab. Paul?
When we were raising, I think we were about $4 million ARR, and we raised 16. We're coming up to sort of drawing down towards 10 at the back end of this year. But it's actually interesting that the there are these sort of thresholds, these magic thresholds that I didn't know about, which was also useful to know. It's like, for an enterprise SaaS company, 5 million ARR US, that's the number. And interestingly, if you speak to the UK companies, if you tell them you're at 5 million US, it's fine. But like, it's the confusion. If you were to say it in pounds, they just sort of still use the same threshold. So definitely always talking dollars. That's one of the things that I've had. And then there's like a magic threshold of $10 million ARR for your sort of Series B. Found out the reason for this is because funds have a thesis when they go out to their LPs, of the people who are their funds, and they say, well, we will invest in companies that are at this threshold. And often there is they cannot invest below 10 million bucks or whatever the case is, because of what they said is their investment thesis for it. And it also helps them sort of divide it up. And I know that the kind of the growth funds, particularly, they don't do anything below 5 million often, then 10 million then becomes that. And apparently 10 million is a threshold for private equity as well. These things sound like bullshit figures, like the kind of thing everyone talks about. Oh, this is what a Series A is. This is how much you should raise. But there are actual thresholds that people cannot push through, and then they're out. Actually, they're out because of it. So I thought that might be helpful for people to know.
And I think also the analysts have this little guideline that exactly are the rules, and they can't take the stuff to the partners unless it ticks certain boxes, unless it's like a standout third time founder who's had X number of exits or whatever. So if you haven't got that sort of top level intro to the senior partner, if you don't tick all those boxes, you just won't get past first base in those different funds. And I think we're SaaS and service, and that just completely blew loads of people's minds. All right, that, and a lot of them were like, no, we're pure SaaS. And that sort of took quite a few out of the mix, because we are SaaS and service. But yeah, that's really good advice, Paul, understanding the rules of the game.
So, John, one last observation, maybe one last thing that hasn't come up, top tip or something you know, or something you wish you'd known.
I think no matter how organised you think your finances are, or your documentation for your tech stack, due diligence is still going to be hard work. And if you think, like I did, that you, because I'm still doing a lot of founder-led sales, that it'll be fine, we can smash all our numbers and I can do the due diligence standing on my head, that's not a thing. Get some help, get some support, get some good people around you, because it's hard. Because you end up basically doing two, founders, you're all doing more than two jobs anyway. But I think during the due diligence process, we also had some challenges around our CFO who was having an operation. So we had this whole, so suddenly Abby, COO, and me suddenly had to get into all the finances and everything. So I just say, don't underestimate how hard it is. And if you are thinking about fundraising in the future, something I regret not doing was actually going to some of the technical due diligence people and maybe paying the money to get some technical due diligence if it was a deal, and ticking off a load of those stuff, because I reckon we could have probably got a bit more money if we'd been a bit further along with some of our tech stack. And actually, we could have probably paid somebody to tell us that earlier. And I'd been like, oh, can we afford that? And actually, I think if we'd afforded that and spent it, it would have paid back dividends.
Joe, what about you?
I think the big one for me, which I think we've been sort of lucky in the end and it's worked out very well, but is like, yeah, just like optimize heavily for people you like, people that you think are going to be good people to spend time with. So we talked earlier about, you know, everyone in the course of fundraising will meet a lot of people that they don't really want to talk to again. And I think that's like, I probably was at some level, you're kind of, you know, at certain parts of a process, or depending where the business is at, you're kind of like, well, I'll take any money's fine. And there's maybe a point where you have to, if you really don't have any other options. But like, these are gonna be people you're gonna be spending a large part of the next few years of your life with, and they're gonna be people who are gonna be there when shit hits the fan, and it almost certainly will for everyone at some point. So yeah, we kind of, like, yeah, indexed very heavily when we were selecting the people that we were going to go with on people that we just thought were like really good people. And then we like sort of back channeled quite hard, both with references they'd given us directly, but also with just like went and like found other companies they'd invested in and spoke to the founders to say, what are they like? You know, have you had bad times? What are they like in the bad times? You know, do they ask you for too much information in a way that's not actually helpful for your business? Like, do you push back if they're kind of asking for something that's unreasonable, you know, all that kind of stuff.
You had a fantastic, was it in Notion? You had a fantastic sheet, which was all the people you were trying to work with. And then you had people like me chipping in saying, I know this person, I can help you here. That, I thought that was a really slick way to do it.
It was really helpful with like, yeah, again, someone else is, you know, not my idea. Someone else had recommended doing it, but like, yes, yeah, so I put together the list of all the investors I thought might be suitable based on kind of what I could, you know, see about people that seem to have a thesis overlap with what we were doing. And then, yeah, we have kind of quite a large number of angels and then some funds who'd invested in us previously. And yeah, basically just ask everyone for like, who do you know, who do you know really well, who you can make a really warm intro to, who could you get an intro to? And then, yeah, like to the point of, you know, not being too keen, I think it is very good advice that like, if you're not reaching out to someone directly, if an investor is hearing about you, particularly if they hear about you from multiple other people, you know, that it starts to begin that little bit of FOMO. And if someone, you know, like in our case, the people are reaching out saying, you should have a look at this Spruce thing, you know, they've already got a term sheet or something. And obviously that makes every VC's ears perk up and go, oh shit, we have to talk to them. You know, it's kind of like, and so you get, you know, a lot of people come in and that again really helps sort of speed things up. And obviously you just want to have as many of those conversations in as tight a period as possible, where ideally you're kind of, you know, they're on the front foot coming to you. And that, so it was, that was really, really helpful. And, good, and yeah, and very appreciative of all the angels who did that.
Paul, last thoughts?
I was kind of thinking of this, the different stages. And I'll go backwards from Series A. Like with Series A, for me, it was like really interesting finding investors who were going to get out of the way and encourage, like push me and the company to be the best it could be. You know, and the kind of like the warning flags were the classic accountants who are going to come in and jump on there who don't have the experience of like building and driving towards fast growth. And so I think that was one of the things that if that's your game, then seek that. And it was within the process actually controlling the different gates of like, yeah, we're going live, first data room is here, we're going to open the first data room on this date, we're going to open the second data room on this date, and we're going to have all term sheets by this date. That was really effective at driving the control, because then when people are like, oh, we want to move forward, it's like we haven't opened it yet. So you can actually corral everyone to be simultaneously at the same time. Didn't work exactly like that, but the theory sounds great. So that's from a Series A perspective. From a kind of a seed sort of piece, like when you're looking at like a kind of a million ARR or something like that, my advice is to find builders, people who've built stuff, because actually you're figuring it out, right? You still don't have product market fit at that point. You're just trying to find out the right sort of, maybe your product market fit, you haven't quite got sales market fit, like you're just constantly changing, still throwing stuff at the wall. If you've got someone that expects this to work like a normal, like a proper operating business, then they're going to slow you down. You've got someone who understands that this is about testing and iterating and burning stuff and trying stuff, and it's not about revenue, it's about finding repeatability, it's finding reference clients and those kind of things. And I think kind of ex-founders, which we were lucky to have in Superseed, were fantastic for that. And I think kind of anywhere below that, my advice is don't. I just don't think today you should be raising pre-seed capital with the state of the technology. Like with two people, you can build a very, very meaningful business using all the AI tools and automation and kind of go forward. And the kind of the thing is, you get with every single new employee you add on, you get this just drag on your time, because you just have this management overhead that you can't get away from. So if it's just two co-founders, like the speed that you can move is just 10 times faster than four or five of you, or 10 of you. But the thing is, when you're starting out, it feels cool to hire people and get an office and things like that. It's like the only thing that matters at that stage is finding product market fit. So therefore, you should focus all your time on finding product market fit, not employing people, not doing any of that other stuff, just like working two people, ideally, you know, building stuff, testing it, getting in front of customers, talking to them, learning, building more stuff, staying up all night, coding a new thing, dropping it, seeing what happens. Like, that's what the game is there. It's not about management. And the only time you should get employee, I reckon, at that stage is to get an EA. And that was a game changer for me. A phenomenal EA joined me about a year and a half, and Tom and I were chatting about it, and she's been incredible. Working with an EA as a founder just can double your time and your capacity, but it's not the same as having a marketing hire or a sales hire and things like that. So I would sort of recommend, don't raise, because then you lose focus. don't employ anyone because you lose focus. Just really keep that team as tight as you possibly can until it's so painful you have to hire more people. And at which point you can afford it because you're making money. So that would be my advice on that pre-seed stage.
Yeah, the only obviously caveat is it you have to have some money to live on. So if you've done something where you can pay yourself or you can just live on savings for a year, 2 years or something, I think that's like, yeah, and you can get far enough with, you know, whatever you're building is can be done or at least can be initially proven with Gen AI or whatever it is, like, or you've got a, if you're non-technical, you've got a technical co-founder, you can go far enough, then I think it's sage. But like, you know, I think it does, you know, for some people founding, you might not be able to, you know, go for more than 6 months without any income whatsoever, even if you're only going to take a, you know, take kind of enough for bread and water. That's probably, I guess, one caveat there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like, because you can get the SEIS in. So, what, £250,000 between two of you? That'll keep you fed and water for 2 years of constant experimentation. Probably you would raise that, but that's often something you can do with your friends and your family in the full kind of round rather than looking at running a fundraise.
Guys, that has been fantastic. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the show. It's been brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Dom.
Cheers, mate.